Chapter 9. The Word of a King. Meanwhile, in Britain, opinion was mixed as to what to do about the gathering storm over the continent. The animosity toward Germany, which had been provoked by the rising German economic challenge, had not decreased, nor had concern over the growth of the German navy and merchant fleet. Nevertheless, an important sector of public opinion and the press opposed British entry into war, especially if Russia might profit by it and be emboldened to strive for hegemony in Europe. The Manchester Guardian prepared a powerful editorial against the war, in which it stated, "We should first of all have it definitely understood that if Russia and France make war, we will not follow them." The Times saw the danger on another front. In a clear-sighted prophecy that is now more valid than ever, it admonished, a general European war would guarantee that the economic future would belong to the American continent, particularly to North America. The threat of the supremacy of a massive and primitive Tsarist Russia, which Britain had felt compelled to oppose on the battlefields of the Crimea 60 years before and which it had warily confronted along the boundaries of its Indian Raj for several decades, occupied Britons more than the distant threat from their American cousins, however. Writing in the Times, Norman Angell predicted that "the object and effect of our entering this war would be to ensure the victory of Russia and her Slavonic allies. Will a dominant Slavonic federation of, say, 200 million autocratically governed people with a very rudimentary civilization but heavily equipped for military aggression be a less dangerous factor in Europe than a dominant Germany of 65 million? The last war we fought on the continent was for the purpose of preventing the growth of Russia. We are now asked to fight for the purpose of promoting it." With public opinion far from enthusiastic about a possible alliance with Russia, the United Kingdom's politicians had to tread lightly, even though the idea of cutting Germany down to size had great appeal for them. Despite Britain's long-standing ambition to control the continent, one can't very well claim that the British ruling class was cut out to rule Europe by reason of its exceptional superiority. The illustrious William Pitt, no matter his accomplishments, and disregarding his sorry end, he died at 47 from his penchant for tippling port wine, can scarcely be compared to Napoleon. In fact, more than one British statesman has been noteworthy for his lack of intellectual accomplishment, from the stodgy Edward Grey, Foreign Secretary in 1914, to the much ballyhooed Winston Churchill, an academic failure. At Balliol College, Oxford, Grey was sent down by the master, Benjamin Jowett, who wrote in the minute book, "Sir Edward Grey, having been repeatedly admonished for idleness and having shown himself entirely ignorant of the work set him in vacation as a condition of his residence, was sent down, but allowed to come up to pass his examination in June." His academic redemption notwithstanding, Grey never achieved a proper understanding of the nations of the continent. Like his people, he knew Europe only as a tourist, passing through in his sleeping car en route to India. He had set foot in Paris just once, a member of King George V's retinue during a state visit. He thought foreigners strange beings, terrible schemers, and once expressed the opinion that foreign statesmen ought to receive their education in one of England's public schools. According to Sir Edward Leitz, had Wilhelm II, Poincaré, Nicholas II, Franz Joseph, and even the redoubtable Paschik been cast in the Etonian mold, Europe would have acquired a sure harmony, particularly if each of the old boys had rendered homage to his Britannic Majesty. As an English observer wrote, Sir Edward had the inborn conviction of the 19th-century Englishman that England's role in Europe was that of a president who convoked conferences and cast the deciding vote. This impeccable Englishman, with his umbrella and top hat, who fished enthusiastically and catalogued the birds he watched in his garden, was charming and agreeable in his private life. But as a custodian of the empire, he was a different man, watchful and jealous of whoever might attempt to raise himself to the dizzying heights reserved for Britain alone. For him, in the end, British supremacy was all that counted. The Irish, the Boers, the Highland Scots, all of them and millions of others had challenged it at their peril. Now, although Grey could never have recognized it, this unique combination, breadth of power and narrowness of outlook, for the first time became a trap not only for Britain's rivals on the continent but for Britain and its empire as well. While Grey was off fishing on Sunday, the 26th, his interim Secretary of State, Sir Arthur Nicholson, had invited the ambassadors of Austria-Hungary, Germany, and Russia to a conference in which they could begin preliminary conversations to defuse the Serbian crisis. By an amusing coincidence, all three ambassadors were related, all of them cousins: Mensdorf, the Austrian, Benkendorf, who despite his German name was Russian, and Lichnowsky, a German with a Slavic name. His father had had to flee Austria after a duel in which he killed a Hungarian nobleman. Lichnowsky was an odd ambassador. He and his wife detested the Kaiser, a fact which his wife had once confessed to Mrs. Asquith, the wife of Britain's prime minister. Like his cousins, he was worldly and vain, and in fact had been commissioned by the Kaiser to keep the British entertained and diverted while the Reich built up its fleet. The three ambassadors were unable even to meet, for their governments shared a mistrust of what the three cousins might intrigue while meeting in distant London. Nevertheless, the fact that the British government had attempted to arrange such a conference, to the exclusion of France, fostered a brief hope that all was not yet lost. In Austria, the most aggrieved of the great powers, there was still sentiment for a settlement. The breaking off of relations with Serbia had caused more fright than enthusiasm. Count Berchtold, the foreign minister, was shattered by the development. A contemporary wrote of him, "Berchtold was perhaps the most frightened man in Europe that afternoon. He had thought to terrify the Serbians. The latter, sure that the Russian colossus, their secret ally, would support them to the hilt in case of trouble, had not given in." It was then that Berchtold became terror-stricken. Meanwhile, a meeting between his brother, Prince Heinrich, and his cousin, George V, at Buckingham Palace had given Kaiser Wilhelm another straw to grasp at. The two royal cousins had passed an hour that Sunday morning, during which George had advised the prince to rejoin his brother in Berlin without delay. When Heinrich asked the king what Britain planned to do, George replied, "According to the report Prince Heinrich made to the Kaiser, we shall try all we can to keep out of this and shall remain neutral." According to notes he made of the talk, George V had a different version of his answer. "I don't know what we shall do. We have no quarrel with anyone and I hope we shall remain neutral. But if Germany declares war on Russia and France joins Russia, then I am afraid we shall be dragged into it. But you can be sure that I and my government will do all that we can to prevent a European war." Whether the two cousins misunderstood each other or King George retreated from his word under pressure is difficult to determine. When the Kaiser heard his brother's version, however, he was transported, in George Malcolm Thompson's words, by sentimental and monarchical enthusiasm. Here was something infinitely more significant and precious than the huckstering of the politicians. The Lord's anointed was speaking to his peer over the confusion and the turmoil. "I have the word of a king," cried Wilhelm. "That is sufficient for me." Unfortunately for Europe, even if Heinrich had understood correctly, kings and their word no longer had much weight. Precisely the kind of politician Wilhelm despised, a man slippery and ambitious beyond measure, was about to make his debut on the stage of international affairs. As Grey was returning from his angling expedition, Britain's first Lord of the Admiralty was swinging into action. He was a born swashbuckler, something of a fantast, who ever since his adolescence had been on the lookout for strife and mischief around the world, from Cuba to the Transvaal, from the Sudan to the Afghan border. The smell of gunpowder worked on him as an aphrodisiac might affect another man. He was already quite a drinker and had something of a stammer. His name was Winston Churchill. That Sunday morning he had accompanied his family to the beach at Cromer. The news sent him hurrying back to his desk at the Admiralty. Even before he left the beach, he telephoned Prince Louis of Battenberg, the First Sea Lord, and asked him to order the British fleet in the Channel not to disperse. In his office, brandishing a cigar, he drafted a communique announcing to the world England's first tangible intervention in the military preparations leading up to the war. No German ships were in sight, nor did the Germans have any plan to send their fleet into the Channel. By this provocative gesture, Britain had cleverly aligned itself with France. As one of Churchill's supporters exclaimed, "Churchill's orders to the fleet will surely be understood in Berlin." Some men continued desperately to search for ways to stave off war. Ambassador Lichnowsky telegraphed Berlin the desire of the British government at Germany put a break to the Austrians. Wilhelm was receptive to the British request. He had become convinced that Austria had carried its demands too far, and in any case the revelation of an unbreakable Russian-Serbian alliance made compromise imperative. He noted in his journal, "Our loyalty to Austria is leading us to political and economic destruction." Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg, however, could not break his habit of temporizing. After receiving the British offer, which was rather conciliatory to the Austrians since it proposed that Austrian forces be allowed to occupy the Serbian capital temporarily, he communicated it to the Austrian Foreign Ministry only after some delay with great reluctance. In this matter, perhaps Sir Edward Grey might be reproached as well, in view of his reluctance to deal with the Austrian Foreign Minister, Count Berchtold, directly. Certainly the snail's pace at which Grey and Bethmann Hollweg set about trying to contact the Austrians for peace stands in sad contrast to the speed which Churchill began mobilizing the Royal Navy for war. Instead of the matter of minutes that it would have been for the transmittal of Grey's vital proposal directly to Vienna, the British proposal arrived there some 50 hours after Serbia's rejection of Austria's demands. Bethmann Hollweg managed also to sabotage a last message from the Kaiser to the Austrians, delaying its dispatch for 9 hours on July 28 in order to insert changes that enlarged the area to be occupied by the Austrians to include neighboring territory mentioned nowhere in the British proposal of 2 days before. By the time the telegram arrived, night had fallen in the Austrian capital. Kaiser Wilhelm's proposal would have to wait until the next day to be read. Then it was too late, for Berchtold had already decided for war. On the morning of July 28, Berchtold composed and sent this note to the Serbian government, the Royal Government of Serbia not having replied in a satisfactory manner to the note delivered it on July 23, 1914 by the Austro-Hungarian minister at Belgrade. The imperial and royal government finds itself under the necessity of safeguarding its own rights and interests, and of resorting for that purpose to force of arms. Austria-Hungary thus considers itself from this moment in a state of war with Serbia. The effect of Austria's declaration of war in London was disastrous for Germany. The Lord Chancellor, Lord Haldane, saw the hand of the Prussian militarists, soon to be a worldwide bogey, in Berchtold's act. "The German General Staff is in the saddle," he announced. Sir Edward Grey, deeply angered, offered the opinion that "something diabolical is brewing in Berlin," as much a self-deception as it was a deception of the British people. In Berlin, Bethmann Hollweg was harshly reprimanded by Kaiser Wilhelm. He was deeply shaken by Austria's declaration of war, which he had in no way desired, despite his attempt to toughen their position against the Serbs. On a diplomatic dispatch which had been sent from London, he wrote, "Austria's duplicity is intolerable. They refuse to give us any information." At 3 o'clock on the morning of the 29th, after some hours pacing the floor in his office on the Wilhelmstrasse, he drafted a telegram to his ambassador in Vienna. He ordered him, very succinctly, to speak with Count Berchtold immediately and very emphatically. A serious war was still not inevitable. Sir Edward Grey ordered his ambassador to call on Sazonov in St. Petersburg and counsel moderation, a far quicker and more direct approach than he had taken with the government of Austria-Hungary. Austria, for its part, was still floating trial balloons. It would take 15 days for the Austrians to mobilize. Only then could they invade Serbia. Better than anyone, Wilhelm II knew there was time to negotiate a peace. He attempted to appeal directly to his cousin Tsar Nicholas II in St. Petersburg, at the very time when Britain's ambassador was telling Sazonov, "One have come to implore you not to consent to any military measure that Germany could interpret as a provocation." Sazonov was not to be so easily moved, however. He had been conferring with France's ambassador Paleolog for the previous 4 days. Paleolog told him, "War may break out at any minute. That eventuality should govern all our diplomatic actions." Sazonov was only too happy to reassure the Frenchman. "Our general staff is becoming impatient," he repeated, again and again.